Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is author and marine scientist, Ellen Prager. And we're talking about her latest book, Dangerous Earth, What We Wish We Knew About Volcanoes, Hurricanes, Climate Change, Earthquakes, and More.
Okay.
Ellen, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Mark. I'm thrilled to be here.
This is a wonderful book, and I can't recommend it enough. And we talked about this off mic, and I want you to take this in the best possible way, but this is like literally a no-bullshit book. You set out what the problems are, what we've learned about them so far, and then what we want to know and why. And it's like you can't help but understand stuff better at the end of this book.
Well, that is like the greatest compliment I've gotten about this book. I really am somebody who I don't beat around the bush. I don't like to put in all this flowery stuff. You know, I wanted to make it easy to understand. I wanted to present some fascinating aspects of the phenomenon in the book, and also I try to bring to the equation the passion that the scientists feel for this stuff.
And the hard work. The hard work. It's really a lot.
The hard work.
Yeah.
Yep, the hard work. And this idea of it's okay to say, I don't know.
Yep.
And that's kind of what drives science and what drives exploration. You know, we're so good at saying, oh, let me tell you everything I know.
Yep.
But rarely does somebody come up and say, oh, let me tell you what I don't know. And so that was kind of the idea behind it was, let me talk to the scientists who are studying things like climate change and volcanoes and hurricanes and ask them what they wish they knew. And boy, let me tell you, it was so interesting to get their responses. I loved that.
One of the things I got out of the book as I got to the end, and you mentioned this right in the beginning, this is a quote, "Earth is beautiful and wondrous, but also frustratingly complex, and at times violent. And as you say at the end of the book, living on the planet Earth is a mixed bag." You know, this really brings home the fact that we're living on a planet, a geological thing that's always changing. That stuff happens to because that's what happens to planetary bodies. And we're in the middle of it.
Right. Well, and, you know, it was really interesting. I think it was in the volcanology community, and I said that, you know, one of the questions I asked the volcanologist was like, are there other messages that you really want me to make sure I try and get out to the public? And one thing they said is, while volcanoes are very dangerous, they're also essential for the planet.
That's right.
And I think that's a really interesting message, that while, you know, we fear earthquakes and volcanoes, these things can be catastrophic, yet they're also what have created the planet that we live on and make it and help to make it habitable.
And one of the other general takeaways I found is science is now, especially in the last 20 years, understands a lot about these events, about how and why they occur. But it's the hope to be able to predict their occurrence that's the thing that most of these things we were still not able to do well at all. Even hurricanes and the weather forecast, we've improved it vastly. But there's still a lot we don't know about predicting.
Well, and I think, unfortunately, this hurricane season has really shown what the number one question when I talk to the hurricane researchers is, how to better predict rapid intensification.
Yep.
And in a warming world, and what we saw this year is that more hurricanes are predicted to rapidly intensify. And that's one of the things they're not good at doing, because it's a very complicated process. It was really fascinating. The other thing that I really came away realizing, I guess I didn't see this until I did the research for the book, was that one of the reasons we don't understand completely or can't predict some of these things is because we can't readily see them. So whether you're talking about, you know, the plumbing of a volcano or under a glacier or in the deep sea, because we can't see these things,
I know.
We have to use indirect measurements, and that makes it really hard.
It's amazingly hard. And we're going to talk by way of example. The first chapter is really the elephant in the room in this whole thing, and that's climate change. And one of the things that there's a huge discussion in your book about is about how ice shells work in Antarctica and how they're eroding and how that process is so complex. And a lot of the stuff we're just learning now about how rapidly it's working.
That's right. And, you know, one of the things we think about is, oh, ice melts, you know, always think the surface melting.
Well, you quote that senator who said, well, why should we worry? Because my ice cube melts and the water level doesn't go up.
Oh, I know.
Oh, my God.
I know. And again, let's just make this very clear. It's not ice floating in the ocean melting that we're worried about. It's ice on land that actually melts and adds volume to the ocean.
That's right.
That's how you get sea level rise. But when we think about it, the last time the glaciers and ice shelves all melted, nobody was here. And so nobody saw it. And so scientists have just had to come up with theories about how it happens and how fast it happens. And what we're learning is, A, we didn't understand it.
Right.
B, it's happening much faster than what was originally thought.
Well, and these big ice shelves start breaking off. Like you start out talking about the Larsen B, the size of Rhode Island, set adrift in 2002. When stuff like that starts to happen, you would think that the entire world would sit up and go, what? What? How, why did that just happen? But it's amazing. It's always on to the next news item.
It is. And, you know, I also don't think people realize that it was so shocking to the scientific community when it happened.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, look, at you, in the movies, you see things like this happening all the time. And so people think maybe that's real or based on reality. Well, when that 2002 breakup happened, it happened faster on a larger scale than scientists had ever seen. And all of a sudden it made them think, oh my gosh, is this how this process works? And could it happen on bigger ice shelves with bigger glaciers behind them? And so for scientists, it was a wake-up call, but for the general public, I don't think it was put in the context that way.
No.
I think it was like, oh, look, here's a really cool picture of something that just happened.
Basically,
but
we
not from, why it was so shocking.
Basically, we need to know how these vast expanses of snow and ice in Antarctica, and then on the other pole and up around Greenland, are going to melt,
right?
How fast, what are the processes? And that's what the process thing is interesting, because what I didn't know, and I learned from reading your book, is the processes sometimes happen from below and above that are breaking these ice shelves off. And then we need to know how fast and how far sea level rises. And of course, and the great thing about your book is you bring it very logically back to basics. We need to understand some aspects of the Earth's climate, like carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. Why is that so important?
Right. Well, you know, so let me go back to the ice shelves. Yes. I mean, one of the things that scientists have discovered, it's not just melting from the surface. They melt from the surface, they crack and they break up, but there's also relatively warm water coming up below the ice shelves and melting them and weakening them, so they break off. And then, again, that allows the glaciers behind them to flow faster to the sea. Now, about carbon dioxide, one of the points I try and make, I hope, clearly in the book,
you do,
is that that's something we actually understand very well, the effects of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. This is not some, like, you know, dark matter question. Or scientists have been studying this for decades, and it's very clear that the more carbon dioxide you have in the atmosphere, the more heat is absorbed from the radiation that's actually being re-emitted from the Earth. And that causes the ocean, the air, and the land to warm. We know this.
And the key thing is our role in all this, and then the burning of fossil fuels.
Right. And we now can trace the kind of carbon in that carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere, and we can trace the increasing amounts back through isotopes back to fossil fuels. So it's not a, like, is it coming from somewhere else? No, we actually, you know, people believe these, you know, forensic shows on television, but they won't believe the climate scientists who can trace where that carbon dioxide is coming from. We know that.
One of the things that people who don't know better always ask is, well, how can you tell about the climate of Earth in the past before there were humans?
Right. I get that a lot. This is just a cyclical thing, right?
Right, right.
What I always say is, I say, you're right. the Earth's climate, the temperature has been going up and down, but we can identify the things that caused the Earth's temperature change in the past versus what it's causing it to do today. And we can do that things like we have the ice cores, we have little small foraminifera that are marine organisms that have a shell, and they essentially trap what the temperature was of the Earth when they made their shells years and years ago. So we have ways of reconstructing what the temperature was and what are the factors that were influencing them. And before humans, there were other factors that were controlling the climate. So we now can show that very readily through the data, which is what I talk about in the book. It's not what I believe. It's what the data is telling us.
That's right. This has little to do at all with belief. It has to do with facts and science and research. What do we know about how fast and how much sea levels are going to rise?
So one of the really interesting facts that has been discovered is that something like, and I'm not going to give you specific amounts because I could get them wrong without looking at the book myself, but like 3 million years ago, when or the last time the carbon dioxide levels were on the equivalent than they are today, sea level was much higher. And so what that tells us is where there's sort of a lag between the time you get the CO2 up to a certain point and the Earth acclimates to it and sea level rises. And it's pretty scary because we're not just talking, you know, 2 or 3 inches. We're talking meters, tens of meters higher. So we don't know how far the sea level is going to rise, but if we look, we can look back to see when CO2 was at the same level, and it's a lot. It's tens of meters. The rate is a really difficult thing to figure out. We know it's accelerating, but that depends on how fast the ice melts, right?
Yeah.
Because one of the things that has been determined is that it used to be that the rate of sea level rise was more because of the thermal. It expands. The molecules expand, and so you get a rise in the volume or sea level. But now we know more of the sea level rise is coming from the melting of glaciers and ice sheets from the land. But the exact rate is incredibly difficult to determine because we don't understand how that's happening.
But scientists are starting to figure that out. And we've talked about that before, finding out that some of the ice sheets are melting from above and below. They're essentially being scoured out from below because the water's warmer. It's the same thing that happens in your driveway when water runs underneath the ice in the spring. You'll see it scoured out from underneath. There's an alarming color photograph in your book that I had not seen before, and I don't know why I hadn't seen this before, of a huge waterfall in Antarctica.
Yep.
That...
Yeah, it's pretty startling.
Was that always there? There's this huge puddling of water behind it, like lakes. And there's this enormous waterfall as it falls off the edge of the ice. And I looked at it and I went, wow, this looks like it's melting like we see here in New England in the summertime, in the spring.
Right. Well, one of the problems in Antarctica and in the Arctic, we don't have any way to look at long-term trends of melting necessarily.
Yep.
And so that we've seen, since we've gotten satellite imagery and since we've gotten some other technology to be able to go in and see it, I think it was a 2016 study that showed that there was melting further inland than they ever expected. And there were these huge ponds and lakes and waterfalls.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we're now just starting to see these things actually happening. And again, remember what I said before, part of the reason we don't understand them is because we haven't had our eyes on them.
Well, you know, I think this is a misconception that the public has, that science can just go anywhere and do everything. You know, like, yeah, they could, they should know what's happening in Antarctica. Of course they do. It's incredibly difficult to do scientific research there.
Right. It's very difficult to do research there. It's very difficult to even get data, collect data there. We still don't know, really know, even know what happens in the winter because nobody can be there. So we're just starting to see and record these things happening. And so, again, it's, you know, I think in the last couple of years, this year, they had a lot of reports about melting in Greenland. And you start to see, I remember I have a picture of there was somebody in a dog sled going through. It looked like they were, you know, in like a foot or two of water. What used to be ice was water, and they were trying to dog sled to go through it. So we're starting to see these things actually happening with our own eyes and with the instruments that we now have to observe them.
Well, you're talking about a lot of the new instruments. There was the drop sounds or something like
Right. Well, those have been used in hurricanes, for instance, for a long time from planes. But they're now starting to use them in the Arctic and Antarctic to look at the ocean around the ice. And that's one of the ways we know that some of the ocean is warming, you know, relatively warming and coming up and melting them, because we're starting to get measurements in the ocean around the ice shelves. And people hadn't done that before.
You also mentioned, depending upon what side of the Antarctica you're on, different things are happening.
Right. Well, they sort of split Antarctica in the West Antarctica and the East Antarctica, and people always thought that East Antarctica was much more stable. And so everybody, you'd hear all the reports, oh, West Antarctica, all these things are happening. And people would say, oh, but that's okay, because it's made up for the stability of the East Antarctic glaciers and ice shelves. And now we know that's not true. Some of the very same things that are happening in West Antarctica are happening in East Antarctica, but they were much more difficult to see.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is author and marine scientist Ellen Prager. And we're talking about her latest book. It's a great read. It's scary, but it's a great read. Dangerous Earth, What We Wish We Knew About Volcanoes, Hurricanes, Climate Change, Earthquakes, and More. So that's Antarctica, and there's a lot going on there. But you flip to the north, and those processes are still other processes. They're more complicated. They're happening in the Arctic and in Greenland. A lot of the glaciers in Greenland are retreating, like the Cermak and the Petermann Glacier. The Rink Glacier, they find out, is actually can slide.
Right, right. There again, it's the same thing where these are very difficult places to study and to get to. And so we're just starting to really learn how the ice shelves and these glaciers are melting in Greenland as well. And if you're in a different place, some of the processes are similar.
Okay.
You know, you get these ice shelves breaking up. You're getting what we call submarine melting, or this melting from below. But you also have different challenges. You have a lot of variety in the land underneath the glaciers. There's a lot of diversity of the glaciers and the topography below them in Greenland. So, it's very difficult, but they're seeing the exact same things. And, yeah, some of it's pretty startling. I was really fortunate. I went up to Ilulissat, which is kind of, if you want to go see glaciers and ice shelves melting firsthand, that's the place to go, is Ilulissat, Greenland. And I have to tell you, it was shocking and incredible at the same time. I think I sort of fell in love with that place, and I just have to go back, and I want to bring other people there because it's so astonishing.
There's a photograph in your book of Sarachev Island in Alaska, where the village has been abandoned because it's going into the ocean.
That's right. There's a whole play of factors here in Alaska and the Arctic. So they're having coastal storms, which are eroding the shoreline much more so than in the past. They're also having the thawing of permafrost.
That's what I was going to ask you about next. Right. That's a whole other issue about what's going to happen. We don't know yet what's going to happen when the permafrost melts.
So the thawing of permafrost is something that is happening now.
First, let's define permafrost.
So permafrost is where you have ice, or the ground stays in a sort of solid ice form for more than a year or two at a time.
Okay.
So it's not something that melts seasonally, put it that way. Easy way to think of this, of permafrost, is frozen ground that does not melt seasonally. And so it could be a year, 2 years old. It could be thousands of years old, and it can be thousands of meters thick. It really varies. But what they're starting to see, particularly in the Arctic, is that this frozen ground that normally that does not thaw is starting to thaw. And what it does when it does that is not only do you damage infrastructure that happens to be on it, but you're also releasing either methane or carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
So we talked about carbon dioxide and the effect of an increase in carbon dioxide. What would happen if a lot of methane is released?
Well, methane is kind of carbon dioxide on steroids. It is actually has a stronger ability to absorb heat in the atmosphere, but it doesn't last as long. So it will have the same impact that carbon dioxide is having in the atmosphere. And so it's very worrisome, either of those two things being released by permafrost thaw into the atmosphere, because the whole idea is then you're rapidly increasing the amount of carbon dioxide or methane or the ability to absorb heat, and you're gonna sort of kick up the warming if that happens.
That seems like one of the dangers that's going on here is the scientists have a fairly conservative thought about how processes are going to work over time. And then it seems like the more they discover, it's happening faster than they thought.
That is one of the overall messages. When I talk to climatologists and I, you know, ask them the question of what do you wish you knew, or what's something that surprised you, almost all of them said the things that we thought might happen have already happened, or they're happening faster than we ever thought they would, like permafrost thaw, ice sheet melting, glaciers breaking up, all of that is happening much faster than they originally thought.
Is there a chance that when these events occur, and occur over time, because they'll be continually to occur, that they'll affect each other and there'll be an even more rapid climate response in the negative? In other words, is there sort of a spiral effect that's going on?
Well, there could be. I mean, that's this big question of tipping points.
Yes,
right?
That's what I'm talking about.
Right. Do we get to a point where something happens where we can't go back? And one place where that is a concern is in Antarctica as well as in Greenland, in some areas where the elevation actually decreases inland. So you might have a shelf of land, but then as you go inland under the ice, it actually lowers and it goes below sea level. And so one thought is if you get sea level rising enough and the ice melting enough and it comes in and goes under the ice into these depressions, then you're going to trigger unstoppable melting. Is that possible? Yes. Do we know it's occurring? No. Is there still time to stop it? I hope so.
Well, that's the scary thing. Like, have we reached the tipping point? We don't know yet.
We don't know that yet. I still think there's time, because one of the other things we also don't know is how fast could things recover.
Right.
If we really reduce emissions and if we start conserving, things could recover faster than we think. And I have to say, for me, it's not just reducing emissions. I think we need to invest in technology to capture carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Because you can't just say we're going to reduce and expect it to go down fast enough. But humans are very ingenious. I fully believe we can do this. But there needs to be the political will and the financial investments to do it. So, you know, whether we're at that tipping point or not, let's not worry about that so much as let's do what we can to stop it and turn the tide.
What do you think the effects are on weather is going to be on things like hurricanes? I mean, are we already starting to see some of the results of this? Because this hurricane season seemed like it was amazing. They ran out of names.
There's no question, not only this hurricane season, but even a few in the past, we're already seeing the impacts of climate change. Now, the formation of hurricanes is not due to climate change, but their extreme impacts are. And there are two really easy examples to understand. One is if the ocean is warmer, you have more fuel for stronger hurricanes.
Right.
And so it's not necessarily that we'll have more hurricanes, but that we'll have more stronger hurricanes because you have that fuel for them to rapidly intensify and grow stronger. And I think we're already seeing that. The other part of this is that in a warmer atmosphere, it's able to hold more moisture. And so when you have these events, they tend to have more precipitation. And we're also beginning to see that these storms are slowing down.
Oh, yeah. That happened several times this year. Yeah. They just sort of moved incredibly slow and dumped a ton of rain.
And Hurricane Harvey was the same thing.
Yeah.
So if you have more, if you have the ability of the atmosphere to hold more moisture, these hurricanes are going to have more precipitation and you're going to have a lot more flooding. And so it's not, you know, we like to say, look, climate change is not causing hurricanes. But climate change unquestionably is causing them to have more extreme impacts. And I think that's an important distinction.
And I want to mention that there's other things that you talk about the impact on, and that includes things like coral reefs, ocean life, and then dead zones, which those I find very disturbing. And that seems to be affected by climate change, too, and the warming of the oceans.
Well, and it is. There's two ways these dead zones. And
well, we're out of time, and people are going to have to buy the book. So think of it that way.
I hope so. Buy the book, but also I hope that it's hopeful in the end because it says we are now beginning to understand these things. We know what we can do to save lives and property and make the Earth a safer place to live.
I hope so. My returning guest tonight, ever hopeful, is the author and marine scientist Ellen Prager. And we're talking about her latest book. This has got all the hardcore information you need to know. By the way, we didn't even talk about the volcanoes and earthquakes, which was amazing in this book. Dangerous Earth, What We Wish We Knew About Volcanoes, Hurricanes, Climate Change, Earthquakes, and More. Ellen, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.